What I got from drug was the same thing as I got from the organization.
Welcome back to my channel. So excited to have you. Wendy Renee here. Today we're talking to Joachim, and he has 26 years of a story to tell you. Fellow XJW has been through so much. Now he's able to use the pain that he went through to help others. Let's get right into it and see how he started the healing process. Before we begin, thank you so much for subscribing to the channel, for liking and sharing our videos as well. It just goes to show that there's more people learning that there is hope and positivity on the other side of high control religion. And if listening to me over share is your jam, be sure to follow me on Instagram and TikTok, because that's what I do. I talk about whatever is on my mind, everything and nothing at the exact same time. If you're listening on the podcast, thank you so much. Please leave a review on the podcast. I'm finding that if more people leave reviews and we can bump it up and your stories can get heard by more and more people every day. So let's get right into it. Thank you so much for coming on the show. We're really excited to have you and to listen to your story and your expertise on the topic. Why don't you give us a little bit of your backstory and tell us what brought you here?
Hi, I'm Joachim. I am from Sweden. I kind of came on here because I wanted to talk about the things that have helped me the most to firstly becoming aware of all the programming that remains and how what to do about it.
Yeah, like once you wake up and once you leave, it still kind of lingers, right?
Yeah, I guess you could say that. Yeah. So, I mean, I left at 16, 1996. I grew up as a Jehovah's Witness. My single mom joined the organization when I was about a year old. So grew up there, got baptized at 15. The only one they ever had, I think, like a mega kingdom hall or whatever, like this. It's a massive one. And I think, you know, when I remember coming up from the water in front of all those people, I had like a panic attack. I didn't realize that at the time, but it was just like literally a voice going, you know, what have you done? Like, and, you know, I wasn't sure about that. I kept going as we do. About a year later, I started college and I went out drinking with some classmates. And I met a girl and spent a night with her. And I woke up the day after and I felt horrible, you know, really afraid, guilty. Like, you know, this is, you know, I've betrayed myself and God and everything. So I went to the elders to come clean. And they were kind of, you know, we kind of expected that, like, you know. And that kind of took me back a little bit. And I was a bit shocked by that response, like, but I when I got restrictions and, you know, no knocking on doors, no answering in the kingdom hall, etc. And I spent about 6 months lying in my bed, being depressed, severe. I didn't go back to school. I just kind of canceled everything and stayed at home and prayed and, you know, regretted what I'd been doing. Like, and then after about 6 months, I figured that, you know, it's not changing. You know, nothing is changing. I was waiting for, you know, some kind of sign or a feeling or something to happen to be like, okay, it's enough. You can move on now, you know, but nothing ever came.
You were a teenager this point, just to keep track. Yeah. Teenager. Wow.
Yeah, so 16 at this point, yeah. So I figured, you know, this is not working, you know, like this is, you know, God appears to be a bit of a prick, like, you know, I'm a kid and I've made a mistake and, you know, I feel horrible about it and, you know, when is it going to end? Like, so I decided to just tell myself, you know, hey, Joachim, you're a kid, you know, you made a mistake. It's not that bad. You're truly sorry. You know, you can't regret this any more than you have. And, you know, it's okay. And kind of instantly, it was just like, okay, was that it? Like, you know, I just had to forgive myself, you know? Mm-hmm. And when I understood that, I got very angry, really been angry. And I phoned him up, the elders, and I asked for a committee and da-da-da. And I went there and I just said, look, I'm leaving. You know, I'm not staying here, you know? There is no, where's the love? Like, you know, there is no, I feel nothing from here. You know, I was I'm just a kid. I was in a vulnerable state. And, you know, I'm not having this, you know, I don't care about this, you know, God, no God. Like, you know, this, you people are a disgrace. And as I was sitting there having that kind of a bit of a rant, I guess we could call it, one of them said, well, you know, you're going to be just like your dad. You know, he's a thief, a drug addict, and a useless human being. And, you know, at this stage, I never met my dad before, ever. I knew he was, some kind of criminal person, or you know, I've never met him. So that also fueled the rage a bit. He was just like, how dare you talk about my dad? Do you know him? Because I don't, like, you know. So, you know, to tell somebody that your dad is a fuck up, you know, when they're a teenager and they've never met him, it's a weird thing to do, by the least, you know. It's kind of a planting a seed in a young, you know, they're not, these were people I'd known all my life, you know, like I looked up to these three elders. And literally,
did they actually know him though, or did they just pull from information that they thought they had about him?
Well, I think he used to know him, so he knew this particular guy. He knew my mom from way back. They were from the same kind of place, so he knew him, but he probably didn't see him for the past 15 years. Like, so what would he know? He could, So that's had me, you know, I was angry, and this is being 1996 in the summer. It was no Google, and no, it was not a library to go to and be like, what's wrong with Jehovah's Witnesses? Like you kind of can today. Like it's very easy it's not easy to maybe actually take that step. But when you have taken that step to find out what Jehovah's Witnesses is all about, it's fairly easy, I guess.
Yeah, easy access.
There's a lot of information around. But at this time, I was kind of angry, and I was just like, I started running, basically, you know, away from there. And it took about 3 months before they read it out in the congregation. They read it out on the 24th of December, 1996. So here in Sweden, people celebrate Christmas the 24th. So it's like, and I spent that day calling all my friends that I grew up with, a whole bunch of them, and just saying goodbye, you know, give me a call if you leave, because I ain't coming back there, like, you know. Yeah, it was a strange day, you know, saying goodbye to everything that you... I didn't have any other friends. I had one friend who was never baptized that I kind of hung out with. But I only had just the one guy. And at this stage, I'd actually met my dad. And, you know, I've met up with him for the first time, and I spent a little bit of time with him.
Wow.
So I was actually at my aunt's, like his sister's house. I never met her previous to that period of time before either. So I also had... I also found this family of mine, you know, even though I didn't know them, it felt like home, you know, like your blood family, my dad and his sister and his brother. And it was just like, well, these people, they know me and I know them, you know. It was a connection.
Right.
Kind of instantly.
Right. And you had never met any of them before this?
No.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So it was some big events in life, sure. I guess. So the 24th of December, so phoning all the people, saying goodbye, and, you know, realizing that, you know, I can't, you know, I'm going to be alone now, well, by having my family and the one friend, etc. But still, it's, you know, giving up all your kind of values, your purpose, what's the point with living, all of these kind of major things that
everything's changed now. Everything you thought you knew, the people you thought you that loved you, everything's changed now.
So basically the same day I tried drugs for the first time, like proper strong drugs or class A drugs or whatever you say, amphetamine. And I was, that worked, you know. It was like, so you can feel like this, you know, there seems to be no reason whatsoever to not feel like this, you know. Coming from the contrast that day, you know, leaving, saying goodbye, and then trying drugs. That, I mean, amphetamine in particular makes you believe things are possible, and, you know, there's like an enthusiasm that it brings with what it does to your brain. Like.
Right.
And obviously, a central stimulating drug. So it was just like, wow, you know, this is cool. I'm going to be doing this now. So, and I did that. I got that from my dad, and I spent a few years doing a lot of drugs. And I kind of, this I realized fairly recently within the past 6 months, that I then swapped Jehovah's Witnesses for drugs. And it's kind of very similar in many ways, you see, because as long as you have your drugs, you don't have to feel, and you don't have to be you know, you can, it's like a crutch, you know, you can just, oh, well, you know, I'll just take these drugs and, you know, I can kind of live, you know. It's like, maybe it's not helpful if you do them all day, every day, but if you have them there, you can always go there. You know, it's like, okay, you can always go to the meetings and you can get some support in whatever choices you're making within the framework of the belief, like, or your friends, or, you know, so it's something to lean on. Wow. To not have to feel.
Wow.
So I spent so many hours of my life since convincing people to try drugs, in fact, you know, a bit like preaching, you know, like, well, you know, we have, you know, Bible says, you know, it's gonna be a paradise over, it's like that. But instead I went, yeah, well, you know, you want to feel okay, try these drugs.
I don't mean to laugh, but it just goes to show that the behavior, it's a behavioral.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. I mean, and wow. you know, it took me a long time. I'm 42 now. Mm-hmm. And I got completely sober and clean from drugs 2 years and 2 months ago. So I took drugs.
Congratulations on that.
Thank you. And it also, it's not until then, I mean, it's not like I've been sitting on the street with a needle in my arm for 23 years. I've had a lot of jobs and got married and, you know, I've done a lot of things, but I always had the drugs there, like always. I could never imagine living without, the drugs were kind of the purpose, you know, a bit like, you know, like there's going to be a paradise, you know, we'll endure this shit now. Because, you know, change is coming. It's going to get better, like you do in the organization. You know, you're supposed to put yourself second or third, and you put preaching and you put God, and, you know, you deny, you're not supposed to feel, you know, your heart is treasures and all these kinds of, all this stuff that, you know, we're not supposed to feel, basically. And the drugs, they help you do that, you know. So they worked wonders for me. I'm not sitting here saying that people should take drugs, perhaps, but to understand what they do for you is very similar, you know, that can be helpful, because we need, if we leave one thing that we've grown up in our whole lives and then there is nothing, you know, that is some crazy stuff, like, so you need to have something to do. That's why I think it's so cool with all the Facebook groups and all the other communities there is, that you can actually find another community now with other ex-Jehovah's Witnesses. It's pretty amazing. It's what you need. Connection.
You were vulnerable, so, is what it sounds like.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I mean, and we all are coming up.
Yeah.
For whatever reason we leave, we are vulnerable. I mean, one of the core instincts that humans have is to be a part of something, right? Attachment is like, we die without our parents when we are small children. And that it remains, you know, it's the same. We always want connection. We always want a purpose, and we always want other people. So, I mean, that's what they threaten us with taking away, right? That's why it's so hard to leave. So anyways, doing drugs for a very long time. and then going to a rehab in Scotland in November 2019. Because the drugs stopped working. You know, it couldn't work anymore. Like, it just made me, I was basically standing on a train track, looking at the trains, going, okay, I'm leaving this shit behind now. And then I thought, I will give it one attempt. I'll try once. I'll really try one. Luckily, I could go to a rehab facility in Scotland. Somebody gave me a book by this Canadian guy called Gabor Mate, called Into the Realms of Hungry Ghosts, which talks about addiction and how it works. Because in general, when people talk about addiction, we don't really know why people get addicted. Like, there's the way you treat addicts in most places of the world doesn't talk about why people actually got addicted in the first place. I mean, we know that a few things make it happen, but not why, not how it actually works in here. And that book kind of explains that. It basically says very briefly that, you know, it's an adaptation. You know, it's not why do you take drugs. It's like, what's the pain? Why the pain? Where does the pain come from? Mm-hmm. And to look at it from that perspective, where is the disconnection from yourself? Like, a trauma is essentially a disconnection to yourself, or a disconnection to your caregivers, perhaps. You know, that creates a disconnection, and then that's how a lot of problems starts. And as I was reading that book, it kind of understood that, you know, like, I'm not, you know, I had a lot of, it's about a month into this place, it was supposed to be there for 3 months. And there was a lot of guilt coming up, like, you know, how could I choose drugs over, you know, my children or relationships, or, you know, how could I make all these choices? You know, like, because when you're sobering up, you're thinking, why would I think that drugs will be better than having dinner with my children, or all these kind of questions, you know, that probably most people would ask. And I figured out that what I got from drugs was the same thing as I got from the organization, you know, safety, hope for the future, connection to other people, purpose. You know, I mean, these are things that every single human being wants and needs to some degree. And I realized that that's what I got from that. You know, I got my dad, I got the drugs making me feel okay, and so on. And I just, you know, there's so many similarities. That's why I talk about addiction here too, because it's, you know, the remaining two months in this rehab facility, watching Gabor Mate videos and reading Bessel van der Kolk's The Body Keeps the Score, Peter Levine, Somatic Experience, and kind of somatic-based therapy modalities and research on this, and how trauma is stored in the body, and how you can, you know, you can go, and there's a lot of Jehovah's Witnesses who have been to a lot of talk therapy. I hear a lot of people say, yeah, well, you know, I went 10 years or 5 years, or somebody says 20 years to talk therapy, and they don't really, it doesn't really get to it. You know, it can be okay, and it, you know, it's nice to be heard and seen and not, but, you know, it stays. There's something, you know, it doesn't go deep enough. And that's the experience that I also had with a few therapists that I tried. I was like, well, I know it was weird, you know, in my childhood, you know, and, you know, sometimes you could kind of relive a story or a trauma, but not necessarily resolve anything, which is kind of pointless to just relive them and not. The point is to essentially get rid of them, or to, you know, to resolve them. Right. And this way of looking at it with a kind of trauma, well, it's very kind of fashionable, I guess, now on, you know, in social media, with trauma informed, trauma this, trauma that.
Yeah, it is.
There is a, and it's not, I would like to add here as well that you could hear a lot of people on the internet going, yeah, well, you know, you just have to take control, and you just have to understand, and you just have to, you know, choose. And but it's, you know, there's a point to that. Is that's one level of it, though. And then there's all this work that you always also have to do. It takes practice, and it's, you know, it's not an easy thing to do. There's no miracle cure, but, you know, that is just maybe you have to make a choice that you're going to work with yourself. You know, that's about the choice you can make. And then you just have to, then the actual work starts. But yeah, anyway, so there's another thing that I figured out there, that I was very kind of black and white. You know, I thought I was this open-minded, easygoing, you know, loving character. And I figured out that most of the things that I had done to be nice to people, you know, I'd be, you know, I was like, yeah, you need to move. Yeah, you call me, like, I'm coming at you. Or, you know, like, you need help, whatever it was, you know, I'd go and help people do lots of things. And I figured, you know, well, that's what you're supposed to do. And I mean, all these things are nice things to do. I had to ask myself, why am I doing these things? And I figured out after a while that I did them so I would feel good, not to actually help you move. But, you know, if I helped you move, that would make me feel okay about me for a moment.
Just recently read about this, that people pleaser, being a people pleaser is a form of manipulation. And it's hard to accept that.
I mean, it's funny, but isn't that really hard? They were like, one of my therapists there was like, you're very controlling. I was like, what do you mean? Like, that is terrible. I'm not controlling nobody. Like, you know, and controlling to me at that stage was like, you know, if you don't do this, you know, I'm going to be angry, and, you know, I'm going to make you force you to kind of do this, and that kind of controlling. But no, it's just, you know, trying to control what people think of you. You know, like acting in a specific way so you will think that I'm in a position. And that, you know, it took me a while to even grasp that. I was like, yeah, but I do that very much. Yeah. I was pretty good at that. I think a lot of us Jehovah's Witnesses, ex-Jehovah's Witnesses, are pretty good at that, because that's kind of how we taught to live, like to exist. Like, you have to present this one, you have to present something to the kind of congregation and to God, essentially, which is the hardest bit, because he fucking sees everything, the bastard, you know, but so it's deep, you know, Like, I think I, in therapy, I figured out that I was about five or six years old when I figured out that God can see what you think, you know? So if I'm at the food store and there's a Snickers and I'm like, oh, let's, fuck, I've already sinned. Like, damn.
Yes, you know, I was the same way. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, and just to, so it's so, so deep and it's so fast, the response of kind of suppressing stuff, like, you know, okay, now I feel whatever my as a therapist, he told me, it's like you have an aversion to feeling, you know, like an aversion to feeling anything. You know, as soon as you start feeling, you're like, I'm going to have to go now, or like I have to sweep the roof, or, you know. And I think that's kind of the head on the nail, like an aversion to feeling, because feeling essentially got us into trouble, you know, like, okay, I like that person, or, you know, I'm angry at that. No, you're supposed to be smiling and happy and, you know, think of God only. So it's like, it's a really deep programming or conditioning or patterning or whatever to call it. Like, so kind of obsessively studying, this, all this trauma kind of informed stuff from PTSD. Bessel van der Kolk's book is like, everybody should have to read that, you know, like mandatory reading now. I think the body keeps the score.
Oh, amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just like, uh-huh, okay, I get it. Like, it's so, it's fabulous. So reading all these books, coming home from rehab, being in a 12-step kind of program, struggling with a God concept, a higher power and God. And, you know, it also helped me to, it's a lot of great things about 12-step programs. Let's take that. You know, there's some things that I don't find so great, but in general, they do a lot of good stuff for a lot of people. They're very helpful and they're amazing in many ways. But this, the God part is you know, the first time they were like, yeah, so God, and you're like, what do you mean God? Like, yeah, well, you know, maybe, you know, there's a higher power, something bigger than you. It's like, well, I pay for this rehab myself. I chose to come here. So what God? Like, I don't need God. And fuck God. I can't deal with the word God. Please take it away. It took me a couple of months to realize that that's the childhood concept of God. Like, there is so many different ways of looking at God, right? It took me 3 months of intense annoyance and to be of discomfort is the word I'm looking for, to get over that and be like, okay, so now I can say, now if I go to 12-step meetings every now and then still, and, you know, they say God, and I don't have to freak out. You know, I can just be like, oh, it's the fear. I feel fear coming up inside of me. And it's like, okay, but yeah, it's not that God, you know, and little kid inside of here, you're okay. Don't worry about it. And, you know, I can kind of move past it now. And then I figured I want to study. I want to become a therapist with this modality that Gabor Mate has come up with, which is called compassionate inquiry. So it's a somatic-based psychotherapeutic approach to trauma, I guess you could say, or, you know, to figure out how to help reconnect people to themselves.
Before we get into somatic healing, how did you change? Because we do have a lot of people in our audience, and I have two interviews in the queue of people who left the organization and want to talk about addiction, and they. Collectively, the higher power aspect has been a challenge across the board. How did you change your mindset of higher power and what you said you had a different version of God that you created? What did that look like for you, and how did you go about that?
I'm very stubborn. No, but it was
you're in good company.
Yeah, no, but it was the whilst in that rehab, you know, I was the place where I came from, you know, essentially staring at the trains, you know, like standing next to the tracks and be like, I'm thinking, okay, I'm doing this, or I'll try the other stuff. So when I was in this rehab facility, and I saw all these people in these 12-step meetings, they had like a 12-step meeting that came there to that rehab once a week. And I saw the people in there and I figured, well, they look all right, you know, they look happy. If that's what it takes, that I swallow this concept for a bit, so be it. Like, I'd rather do that for a while than just go home and kill myself. You know, I owe it to my children and to myself to try. So what I did initially was to decide that for a year's time, I'm just going to take the 12-step stuff and just take it, just eat it. Because I was constantly arguing. I was a terrible guest.
Terrible client. But it sounds like you tapped into your future self as well.
Yeah, and I just thought, you know, I've been doing drugs for so long, 23 years, wow, and not being very happy before that growing up as a Jehovah's Witnesses. And, you know, I need to change something. I understood profoundly and deeply that I needed to change. I needed to do something. I wasn't sure exactly what it was. So I was, as they so neatly say in that program, the gift of desperation. I had that, you know, very much. Mm-hmm. And it was just like, if these other people, you know, if they can have, they look all right, they look happy, they also sound a bit crazy, but they at least smile, you know, and they're clean. So I'm gonna try. So I decided to give it a year and just be like, okay, if you say we came to like step 6 or 7 and my sponsor, I did it kind of my way anyway, because I'm stubborn. I started my own meeting instead of going to other people's meetings and things like that. But and my sponsor had about 3 days longer clean time than me. And he was like this 25-year-old kid, like, but he was kind of, yeah, well, you know, let's just do this. He was positive. So he told me, you know, now you have to pray. You know, you have to go down on your knees and pray. And I was just like, no, that ain't going to happen. I'm not doing that. So like, I'd rather go and die. Like, and he was like, yeah, but listen to yourself. Like, so it took me a few days. And then I figured, you know, I've been doing so many distasteful things in active addiction that I don't have to go into here, but you know, like nasty stuff, like that no sane person would do. But I couldn't bring myself to, in my own home, sit on my knees for 1 minute and go, oh, you know. And I figured out, like, I've done so many humiliating and demeaning things in addiction. Why can't I just do that? You know, and it's such a, but so when I actually did that, it just said click. It was like a physical response in my head. It was just like, and I was just like, it's an ego thing. You know, I was just like, I refused to do that. And it was really hard. And I don't think it had anything to do with God or a high power. It was just my ego. My ego just went, okay, stop thinking you're so fucking cool, you know?
Right.
That helped. But I mean, I completely understand how people really struggle coming into. I mean, some of those 12-step programs probably be worse than others as well, with the kind of Christianity part. You're not supposed to talk about which fellowship you go to. But I went to CA, which is kind of the newest one. So they kind of are less inclined to be like God, 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 God. And they're more laid back with that. So if there's anybody who's really struggling with addiction watching this, I would recommend to go to, it's just a younger fellowship. The other ones are older and they're more kind of, it's kind of more laid back, to be fair, especially around the God part, because none of those programs are actually about God. They're not supposed to be about God. So if people talk about God too much, just ignore it and just do the other stuff. Because sharing with people and connecting with people and to be able to be yourself and all that stuff, that's key for ex-Jehovah's Witnesses in particular.
Thank you for that explanation, by the way. A lot of people are struggling with this that we talk to behind the scenes. I'm sure you talk to behind the scenes. And before we got into that, we talked about your somatic healing. And so can you tell us about that?
Starting in this rehab facility, I mean, I was... It's kind of either you do shit or you don't kind of person, you know, black or white, which is, I have also figured out a residue from the organization. Well, either you're doing it, you know, or you ain't. You're not doing it half-heartedly. And one day you're like, yes, well, God, you know, it'd be all right. It's like either you're fucking in it or you're not in it, right? Catholics or a lot of other major big religions, not Catholics in particular, all other big, like big religions. You see people there like, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, they're not that, it's not that hardcore. Like, of course, there's, right. Yeah. So, but I was just like, okay, so now I'm going to do therapy and I'm going to learn about this stuff. So I did that, you know, like, I threw myself into it, reading. And then I bought a kind of short course that I went through. And it was also like, it's basically just sit with how you feel, you know? So that's triggering for you, like whatever it might be. You're triggered, you're finding yourself angry or upset, sad, whatever it is, just stay with it, which is really hard, really, really, really hard in the beginning. So you have to do it gradually. You start maybe noticing, okay, I was angry before, you know, and you be like, and you do that, this takes time. And it's much easier if you have other people on a similar, who understands you, let's say. It doesn't have to be a therapist necessarily, but, you know, it could be your mates or, you know, a support group or something. So just, I also started meditating whilst in the rehab. I really like meditating. I think that's a major part of my of recovery from drugs and from you know, it's to integrate stuff. You know, that's when it integrates. You know, you can figure out a lot of stuff in here and you can read all sorts of books and you can watch documentaries about this and that and you get it in here. But then you still keep fucking doing the same stuff. Like unconscious, it's figuring out the unconscious belief or the unconscious patterns. You know, it's a bit like when you've just got your driving license, you know, you're like, you drive around tense and you're like, and then after 10 years, you're just driving, you know, and you're on the phone and you're on your laptop and you're talking to the kids in the backseat and you're just driving, you know, you do it unconsciously. Mm-hmm. And the things we could do, I mean, 90% of what we do is we do kind of unconsciously. It's only about 10% that's actually like now, okay, I'm now waving to you, I'm doing that consciously. That's like, you know, the way most of the stuff we do is unconscious. So it's about to figure out the stuff that we do that are unconscious.
Even meditation is a buzzword, is a trigger word for a lot of XJWs, because as we all know, the organization, they kind of are the gatekeeper of words. They recreate them or they redefine them. So when you're coming out of the organization, meditation is like, wait a minute, I was told to meditate on this. And it's a different, it's not actual meditation that you were doing in the organization.
No. All right. So, I mean, you could call it, anything really. It's just like, take a deep breath, mm-hmm. notice what goes on in your body. That's it, pretty much. Like, you know, and then that can be, you know, you can do it in many different ways, obviously, but some kind of mindfulness. Just it's about, maybe that's mm-hmm. a kind of word, but I mean, or just what I do these group therapies for XJWs. And a thing I learned recently is like a Hakumi practice. It's like a mindfulness something, and it's basically you'll be I can do it with you now. It takes just 30 seconds. Like I'd sit here and I go, I notice the air in the room is slightly cold against my skin, and I notice the floor under my feet, the soles of my feet are touching the floor, and I can feel my heart beating. And that's just little things like that. It can be anything, you know. It can be, you know, I have a pressure in my chest or a tension in my shoulders, or, you know, my nose is cold, or, you know, the tingling in the finger or whatever it be. So just take a moment and be like, what's happening? What am I experiencing on a physical kind of level?
Body scan is basically what it is.
A body scan, yeah. So, I mean, what about your feet? Yeah, are they touching the ground? Yeah, they're touching the ground. Okay, so... Mm-hmm. The sensation of the foot touching the floor, how does that feel? And that brings you into the present moment, because you can't, and it's breathing as well, it's a helpful thing. You know, you can't breathe yesterday or tomorrow, you can only breathe now, like, and that's it. So it's a just practice to be with whatever goes on. So to raise the awareness of what's actually happening for me right now. I mean, that to do that in any shape or form, with whatever method or whatever you do, that is the beginning of it, I'd say. That's the beginning of the, I mean, people in social media are like, the work, you know, you have to do the work, you have to do this. That is the fucking work. Like, you know, it's not more complicated than that. It can be very fucking hard at times because we can have a lot of stuff coming up. So it's not easy, but it's not, you know, it's simple, but it's not easy.
Not easy. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So doing that, meditating a lot and, you know, reading a lot and going to a lot of 12-step meetings, to be fair, because that gives you a practice of sharing honestly. You know, like I can sit here now and talk to you and talk from my heart, or, you know, I don't have to prepare, and I don't have to pretend I'm something I'm not. I don't have to hide parts of me. I mean, we all have masks to some degree, you know, when we go to work, we have it. But, you know, that's kind of normal level stuff. But this is what we're usually dealing with, is that we're hiding ourselves, like under layers of layers of, because it's a fear of death beneath, you know, it's a fear of being shunned, fear of losing everything you know and have. And, you know, at the core of it, to die in a brutal death in Armageddon. Like, and that's, we've been taught that since we were small children. So that stays there. You know, I, if you would have asked me 2 years ago, are you afraid of dying in Armageddon? I would have laughed at you. I would have said, no. I mean, that's insane. But actually in my body, there's still a fear of that. Like, there's a part of me, a child part of me, if you will, that can get triggered about that. As I was starting up my group therapy groups, and I was in a Swedish newspaper thing, doing an interview, like, I was born and raised as a Jehovah's Witness, addiction, blah blah blah, similar to what we're doing here, but in a paper. And I was so afraid when they were going to publish that, and I was like, it's so strange to be, I don't understand this fear, you know. And I'd done some inquiries or some therapy sessions on it, and just staying with the, you know, what's going on in the body. And I it came up to being afraid of dying, you know, like a terror, a real fear of dying. And it's just like, intellectually, it's like, you know, it's like, why? But on a physical level, that's what they mean. You know, the body keeps this score, essentially. Right. There's this fear there. And there's another thing that usually comes up for people in this setting, there's a lot of grief. It's not necessarily grief of, it can be grief of losing family, but it's also a grief for you. For me, I have grief for me and the lost childhood and the lost possibilities. And there's so much things that could have been and that shouldn't have been. So to try to be aware, to raise your awareness about what's actually happening for yourself would be the starting point for any kind of this kind of work, for any kind of therapeutic work. I probably, like, it's a broad statement now, but yeah.
But also admitting I'm not okay, number one. And we're also in this interesting culture of constantly fixing ourselves. There's this book I recently read called Stop Fixing Yourself. We get so focused on our imperfections that we don't give ourselves time to focus on one thing that we want to change or heal. And we're moving on to the next assumed character flaw that we may have, or we're in this generation or this, again, culture of there's something wrong with me. And then what that does is our indoctrination and our past feeds into that. And so we kind of have to stop this whole mentality of there's something wrong with me. Or we were talking about that earlier, that being people pleasers is a form of manipulation, or because the organization breeds people pleasers and people who are just kind of robotic. We were always going through the motions and there was never any feeling. There was never any permission to trust our intuition and to practice mindfulness and say, you know what, today I'm feeling this certain kind of way today. And that's okay. It doesn't mean there's anything wrong with me. It doesn't mean I need to fix something. I'm just feeling a certain kind of way today. So in everything that you're saying, would you say that acceptance is one of the crucial components to stepping into mindfulness?
Of course, yeah. I mean, and in that it's hard to accept something that we don't understand. Like, you know, but you know, at the core of it is definitely acceptance, you know. And it's like you say, the society in general is not like, take a moment and check in with yourself. Nobody ever said that anywhere, you know, in society, at work or in school, or, you know, it's the other way around.
Right.
You know, it's just like, fucking move on and, you know, don't.
Right.
You know, so it's not only there.
Yeah.
And I mean, and also the organization, which is, I mean, I know that you talk about narcissism sometimes on here. And I mean, yeah, it's like we get, I mean, God, Jehovah, is like the biggest fucking narcissist ever, in a sense.
Like, yes.
I mean, it's just like, and that's the kind of dynamic, you know, like, it's just like, I am the most, you know, push your feelings away and put me. And it's just like, Yeah.
Like, why so vague? I was talking to one of our PMO friends just yesterday, and they said, if I were to write a letter to my kids of something that I thought was important for them to better them, I wouldn't leave it open to interpretation. I wouldn't leave it vague. I wouldn't leave them wondering my motives or what of their future. That sounds like it's a form of control, is what you want people to just blindly obey and blind faith.
That he has a whole organization enforcing his ship, basically.
Well, it's also a toxic relationship. It's interesting when you, I really am moved by how you compared the life of a Jehovah's Witness to what you endured when you were going through addiction for all those years. And when you step back, it's being in the organization is a toxic relationship. And so I always say, seeing the organization as an actual person, would you hang out with this person? Would you spend time with this person? How do they make you feel, et cetera? Yeah. And so I find that very interesting that you mentioned that.
I started after a while in rehab on my smuggled in mobile phones, kept watching videos. And I found that, you know, they have a modality. He created a modality as this psychotherapy, compassionate inquiry, Gabor Mate and this other Canadian woman, Sataram. And I figured, you know, I want to study that. I want to get into this. Like, initially for me to work more on me and to understand more about me and to be able to work with addiction in a better way. Because, yeah, there's a lot of improvements to be made in that field, let's say. And then as I'm doing that, it's basically 1 year, the initial training, and the first 3 months, you go through these 8 modules and you only look at yourself. Like, and you have a minimum of 90 minutes a week where you're a therapist or and client and the observer. So, and I've done double of that because I'm a bit crazy with these things. So I've done for a year, I've had at least 2 90-minute sessions every week. Mm-hmm. And classes and all the readings and all the lectures and all that. And the first 3 months, you only look at yourself. You know, what comes up for me when I look at this material? You know, and they go through it. It's a wide variety of stuff. And you just, okay, well, how does that feel? You know, because the idea is that if I'm going to be working with somebody and I get triggered, I need to be able to be very fucking aware of that. You know, like, right. Everybody's always going to be triggered. Like, but it's about, do we have the capacity to understand that we are triggered and can we take responsibility for that and rather kind of respond? Because otherwise, what we do for most people is to just recreate the trauma. Mm-hmm. You know, you're telling me something and I'm like, oh, well, you know, you should do. Then, you know, that's just the same shit all over again.
Right.
So that's not good. So it's like, it's a lot of self-therapy or whatever to call it, like, involved. And then there's another 3 months where you kind of keep looking with one eye on yourself and one eye on the actual client. Like, and then there's the third level where you kind of start integrating kind of techniques or various ways of asking, questioning stuff, like to get to, it's essentially about, when did you lose the connection to yourself? Like, what happened? And it doesn't necessarily have to be, okay, it was the 4th of December, 1985. It's got nothing to do with that. Or the actual, I mean, a traumatic event is not, if you're in a fire, it's not the fire, that's the trauma. The trauma is in you. It's whatever happens in you. So you can be in a horrible, you can be in a war zone or in an accident or whatever. As long as you have connection and you can share about it and be understood afterwards, there is a very small chance of you getting a PTSD or post-traumatic reaction to it. It's when you are disconnected and you're staying with it and it stays in your body, which is, you know, it can happen in so many ways in the developmental, in the early stages of life. You know, if you have a baby in a cot screaming, and I don't know, now it's probably less common, but as I grew up, I'm born in 1979, it was like, okay, we're not going to pick the child up because it needs to learn that it's supposed to sleep at night.
Right.
I mean,
right.
It still happens in places, you know? Mm-hmm. And that, so the 6 month baby or the 2-year-olds or even the 5-year-old or whatever, they don't understand that, okay, mom is thinking that, you know, I should sleep, or mommy is too tired, or mommy is not. Whatever the reason might be, you know, no parents are, you know, cruel intentionally towards their children. Well, all parents have different capacities to look after their children, but they all have the best of intention. That's for sure. So what a child learns at that stage, then if they essentially don't get their needs met, they don't understand that it's about, you know, maybe mommy's busy or, you know, whatever it might be. They just make it their fault. Mm-hmm. So you learn you could grow up with an inner core belief that, you know, it's no point for me speaking up.
As a mom, when I had my kids, it was still a popular mentality, the cry it out method. And one of the things that changed my life about it, and when you're a new parent, you kind of are going by the opinions of others. You haven't really stepped into your own intuition. And then one thing that changed me was someone said, well, the baby stops crying. And I said, and I thought to myself, well, what that taught the baby is that mom's not coming. So you're teaching them that their only caretaker is not going to show up. I'm really glad you're talking about this because it is a core memory.
Yeah. And then the baby, you know, it's not that it just gives up and it's like, okay, mom isn't coming. It just passes out usually from exhaustion. Yeah,
exhaustion.
You know, and it's just like, and it learns. I mean, obviously, if we miss that our children are screening once, that does not have to ruin them forever. But if it's a continuous
pattern. Right, yeah. right.
And, you know, I have children, I have twins, they're about to be 11 years old. Mm-hmm. And, you know, at the beginning of this course, you know, I was just like, oh, fuck. You know, like, yeah, I'm going to have to pay $9 billion in therapy forever. Oh, no. But it's not, obviously, basically, it's impossible for anybody to give their child a, like, perfect score in the way, in remaining the connection. It's also about reconnecting, you know, if we break that connection that we have, then it's about reconnecting. You know, obviously sometimes we have to break it, you know, it can be if they do something dangerous or whatever, and, you know, I mean, there's all sorts of reasons, but continuity. Yeah, that's it. Being about 8 months or in October last year, somebody in that course, I think that you spoke to recently, Viviane, she was also studying the same thing. And she was like, yeah, you should check out these XJW groups that I'm in. And I was like, I don't really want to talk to any XJWs. Like, why would I want to talk to them? Like, you know, I don't have anything in common with them. Or that's what I thought.
Right.
But also during this time of the first 8 months of kind of intense therapy, more and more things came up, you know, and I realized that, you know, the fear of God, the fear of not being good enough, and, you know, thinking that I don't fit in anywhere, always being an outsider, I'm essentially unlovable. And, you know, if somebody forces me to admit, if I perceive somebody's forcing me to admit something, I would, you know, respond with fury or rage. Like, and I had all these patterns that I've been going through, in particular in relationships. I think they show up the most because that's when you're vulnerable, I guess. And I figure, thinking about all this stuff, and, you know, feeling where in the body are these things sitting and what's going on. You know, one thing that I usually take up as an example is my son. He'd be notoriously picky with his food. Like, so I'd give him a plate of fish fingers and chips or whatever, and he'd be like, oh, I'll have that. And, you know, my response is in here is just like, you know, this I'm grateful, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, this rage, you know, and looking at that in these sessions, just staying with it, you know. And I'm explaining this because maybe people don't, you know, maybe the word therapy is scary even. But, so what I'm talking about is just staying with that emotion. And you do that in the presence of somebody else. So if I'm sitting here with you and you're kind of witnessing, pun intended, my experience, you know, that can give me a permission to stay with that feeling. So it's in order to be able to look at these unconscious things or whatever happens in the body, it can be very hard on your own because we don't allow ourselves to look at these things. But if you do it with somebody else, or in a group, for example, and there is other people who understands what you're talking about, and they hold the space for you. And there's just a space where you can actually tap into who you really are and how you really feel, and not have to change that. And you know, it takes time, obviously, to build up a safety or a connection, essentially. I mean, it's the same with addiction. They say the opposite of addiction is not abstinence, it's connection. It's not until we lose the connection to ourselves and to others in a relationship, both to the organization and to perhaps God and to our parents, then we need to be in another relational space or another relational box where it's safe to express how we feel. And that's how we can kind of work through the stuff.
So beautiful. One of the reasons I wanted to also have you on here is because you actually work with people and you do this for a living. So can you talk about some of your programs, resources you can offer to people who are watching this right now, and where they can, hold on. I just want to say we're already at an hour and I want you to be able to drop where people can find you. And I really want you to be a resource for people watching this. This is a new language for so many people that leave the organization. There are so many people who still leave with this anger. And I'm not saying anger is a bad thing. I love that you said, hold on to it and sit in it. And I'm a big proponent of sit in the suck and feel the feels 100%. Mm-hmm. And I love that you are so experienced in not only helping people step into their bodies, but it's at some point, the organization still has a hold on these people, even when they leave. One of the reasons that I was really excited to have you on the show is not only because of your experience in the JW world, and thank you so much for being vulnerable and sharing what you went through with addiction. It's so common for the viewers on our show that I know it's going to be a source of healing, but also we really want you to be a resource to the people who are suffering.
Yeah. So I do work individually with people. And I mean, it's along the same lines. And then we have I have a group therapy project that I do with another XJW therapist called Andreas. That's a 10-week program that we're in the first round of it now, which is a major thing because self-compassion is so hard to get to. Like, you know, I can have compassion for something that you do, you know, but the way that many people talk to themselves or the way that many people judge themselves, they would never speak to anybody else like that. And we don't even know that because it's just happening there. Like, so to kind of get these things out in the open carefully and in a safe space, like build your capacity to feel and experience your emotions, celebrate the possibility that lies within, become comfortable with your vulnerability. So it's things, points like this, that both in the individual kind of sessions that I do, that is the kind of basis of it. So that's what you work with. And it's the same in the group that we have with the 10-week program, which is more structured and in a group. And for me, it can also be very scary to go to a group, and I understand that. So for some people, it's cool to start with a one-on-one kind of thing to get a feeling about what it is. But when you're actually there and you can go, if you can join a group, for me, it's like a turbo version, because if you have 10 people or 5 people and you share something, that's going to resonate with me. So I get something from you sharing your stuff. So it's like, so if you have 5 people sharing, you get 5 things instead of just your own thing, and you get different perspectives, and you very much understand on an emotional kind of level that you're not alone. We all human beings, we're all the same. We're all the emotions that we experience are the same. We can have different stories.
You're helping people reestablish connection, not just with themselves, not just with their own body, but other people, to learn how to trust themselves, to learn how to see their stories in other people, to learn how to trust other people, to learn how to work with empathy and self-compassion for ourselves, I think, is something that a lot of people really could use right now. If somebody wanted to contact you, we can put all of your social media and all your contact information in the description box, how to locate you about this program. And we would love to have you back on, and maybe we can talk about a targeted topic.
That sounds like a fabulous idea. I'd love to, to do that.
Cool. Yeah. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for watching the show. And if you want to contact Joachim, his contact information is in the description box. And if you want to be on the show and tell your story, you can do so by emailing me, wendyrenee@gmail.com, or go to my website, wendyrenee.com, and click on the Be on the Show tab, and the schedule will pop right up. That's all we have for today. Thank you so much for watching.